And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. You can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM, and you can check us out, Taylor-Report.com on the web. And today we're going to talk about the there's breaking news, as they say in the business. Leon Mugesera is being removed from Canada, as probably aboard the plane now. There's been... So, anyway, we're going to get into that. Later in the program, half hour point, we're going to talk to an authority on matters to do with Syria, Iran, Libya, and this would be Zafar Bengash, who has recently returned, I believe, from a trip to the region. I know he was in Turkey, and anybody who's paying attention knows that there are wars and rumors of wars, so we want to be aware of what's going on. And... to begin with, though, let's just mention Leon Mugesera, who we've discussed on this program, an academic, a man who lectured at Laval University and who was educated at universities in Quebec many years ago, went on to become a professor and a minister, and I should already change my definition here, a deputy to a minister in the Rwandan government. He left Rwanda in 1992. He's been in Canada since that time, since 93, and he has been under various orders to leave and then others to stay. And meanwhile, he's raised a family. We discussed him on this program. We talked with last week, I believe it was. We talked to Mr. Tiajen Rudasingwa, who had been a high-ranking figure in the present government of Rwanda, the one that is asking that Leon Mugesera be sent to Rwanda. This former minister, Mr. Rudasingwa, says you ought not to do that. Not because he cares about the particular case or has a direct interest in it, but because he says the government that he served is a criminal government known for assassinating its opponents, and that there is absolutely no debate about that. And it seems to have been evolved here. I mean, that was the argument of Mr. Rudasingwa. Look, it's a criminal government. You don't do that. And make sure he gets due process. If you want, if you believe he's guilty of some offense, and let your attorney general do the investigation. And if you wish, prosecute him. There have been prosecutions in Canada, by the way, of Rwandans accused of crimes in Rwanda. But this government has chosen to, I think, make a poster boy of Leon Mugesera. So they've decided they're going to remove him. Now, the lawyer, Philippe La Rochelle, went into court last week, a Quebec lawyer, who, with considerable experience, he is defending an accused, actually a Rwandan accused in Canada, of crimes in Rwanda. The case is to begin in April, so he knows quite a bit about this matter. He's also acted as a lawyer in Arusha, Tanzania, at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Mr. La Rochelle went to court and made a very trenchant point that all Canadians ought to be alert to. I mean, we are a country full of immigrants from all over the place, and there are many people who have emerged from countries that have serious political strife with assassination, murder, and whatnot. And so when issues of, well, should the person be here, usually turns into a political argument of who are you and which side are you on, and et cetera. And fundamental rights tend to get tossed out the window. But Mr. La Rochelle pointed out in his argument before the federal court that he said the Canadian government is a signatory to a treaty which protects people from removal to countries which practice, are known to practice torture, and that, that there is an institution within the UN structure, which investigates allegations. So, for example, in Mr. Mugesera's case, he says that he would be subject to all kinds of extra-legal torment and torture and perhaps murder if he is removed to Rwanda. Now, La Rochelle says Canada's signatory to the agreement. Therefore, he said, why don't you, I'm not asking you to do act on behalf of Mr. Mugesera. I'm asking you to act on behalf of your own signature. You signed the agreement, and so you recognize that that's an issue, and you also are recognizing that the appropriate institution has been established to investigate allegations so as to make sure that people are protected against that risk. So how is it you are now going to just remove this person without honoring your own commitments? So he said, I'm asking you to honor your own commitment. It's interesting. They're not doing that. So that's why I bring it back to the issue of poster boy. They've decided they've got themselves a guy who has been certainly the victim of wonderful misrepresentation of his identity and also of what the nature of this is, his case is about. And I could tell you many liberals in Canada have worked zealously to make sure he's misrepresented. They've gone out of their way to convey false information about Mr. Mugesera. I'll just start with the most important fact. Mr. Mugesera is alleged to have given a speech of a certain content, a kind of a violent speech, in the year 1992. The events that took place in that people call the genocide or the massacre, certainly war slash massacre for sure, of people in Rwanda took place in 1994. Mr. Mugesera was not in the country. He had left the country in 1992. So you're talking about someone who gave a speech in which the Globe and Mail and others think they're authorities on what was the content of the speech, but he is not someone who was present or participated in the actions of 1994, 2 years later. He was abroad. No one has argued, no one brought any evidence that he participated in an incitement from abroad of violence. He didn't say or participate in anything to do with that country in 1994. So very often when we talk about issues of mass murder and incitement and all that, people caution, be careful about if you say speech. Speech is a very hard area to, you know, if a guy gives a violent speech on a street corner and then a month later someone blows up a building or someone's attacked, it's generally regarded as, to say that he gave that speech and then that person did that because he gave that speech, that's a stretch. And you better be diligent to show that there's any connection between the two things. But the other very important detail about Leon Mugesera you need to know is that at the time that the speech was given, and we know this about it, he wasn't the featured speaker. It was a regional meeting, and he was not the big shot about to give a speech. He was called on to fill up a speaking space. That is, they had a major featured speaker. He wasn't it. They called on him to speak. Okay, so now at the time that this took place, the Attorney General of the country belonged to a different political party than Leon Mugesera. And this involves us already in deeply into the Rwandan politics, if you want to understand what happened there. This was a united front government. It was a government of different parties that did not like each other. So the ministers of these parties would use that ministry to cause trouble with their rivals. So Mr. Mugesera was a member of the MRND party, and the minister of the of justice was in the MDR. I call him the Attorney General. I'm speaking broadly here. At any rate, what you need to know is that he was prosecuted. The government of Rwanda in the year 1992, which would be the year the president of the country is Juvenal Habyarimana. And people call him a dictator. By the way, it's kind of strange. I mean, the cabinet under this, quote, dictator was a cabinet full of different parties, and they were causing each other grief. And they tended to act on political motivation. At any rate, the minister decided to bring in a charge against Leon Mugesera. So Leon Mugesera left the country because he was charged by the government of Habyarimana. And if your mind ought to begin to spin now, because this is the government, allegedly was the Hutu extremist government, that it is the government of Habyarimana that was wanted to investigate whether or not Leon Mugesera had given, quotes, an extremist speech. He felt sufficiently frightened by that he left the country. By the way, no human rights body, nobody abroad thought that was a bad thing, that he fled at that time. Nobody was anxious to bring him back, because at that time, all the human rights people were anxious to give President Habyarimana a hard time. So they didn't want it widely known that his government was bringing an action against someone who had given an allegedly Hutu extremist speech. It was the government of Habyarimana that wanted him brought back. By the way, no one cooperated. Nobody said, oh, my goodness, of course, he's given an extremist speech, he should go back. No. He was a victim. At that time, they decided to portray him as a victim of Habyarimana. You like funny stories. The man who brought the action against Leon Mugesera, accusing him of extremist speech, 4 years later, was himself a refugee because there had been a war and mayhem, and he fled abroad, and he found himself accused of genocide. This is the guy who brought the original action. So when the Globe and Mail and everybody tries to sum it up nicely for us, they're leaving out a lot of details. That Leon Mugesera didn't kill anybody. He never advocated killing. And the piece of the speech, okay, you could say he said something extreme in 1992. When all the violence happened, he didn't say, oh, goody, now we have violence and I'm all in favor of this. No, he didn't give any such speech. So this is, they've decided, okay, we've got a little soundbite on him, provided to us by the U.S. Embassy via a very famous human rights advocate, Alison DeForge. She provided us with a wonderful little story. By the way, when she went into a courtroom and she said she had the tape of his speech, which she and others then translated because it was given in Kinyarwanda, naturally the judges said, where did you get the speech? And she said, well, it was someone gave it to me. And they said, well, you can't just walk into court and tell us somebody gave you that. Who gave it to you? She said, well, it was an embassy. I don't want to name the embassy. And they said, well, you have to name the embassy. She didn't name the embassy. Now, I'm saying it was the U.S. embassy. She never told anybody. So she was allowed to come into court bringing this bit of tape and then also provide the translation. When that was tested in front of a Canadian judge, the Canadian judge says this has been manipulated. This is a political matter. Somebody is trying to, you know. And so the Canadian court was unimpressed. But the ministers and the government, they were very impressed. They decided, sure, we can string him up. Well, of course you string him up. You've named him. You've given him a lot of bad names. By the way, now to bring it back to his life, I happen to know the man because as an investigator, one of my jobs was to go around and interview people who had information. So I once went to talk to him, more than once. I know his family, etc. So here you have a family, slowly evolving. I knew them when they were little children. Now they're all university people. One of them is a lawyer. They're Canadians. And a man who gave a speech in 1992, 2 years before terrible violence, but who fled the country because he was pursued by the government of Habyarimana, now you want to send him back to face justice in front of the people who were fighting the Habyarimana government. You have to try to put all that together. It should give you a headache because it doesn't compute. It does not make any sense at all. That here he produces a wonderful family that are now torn to pieces because a minister wants to show that he's going to not be soft on bad Africans. And he's got a poster boy bad African. Anyhow, that's what, and as I'm giving you this report, Leon Mugesera was on the plane today. Previously on this program, we talked about the nature of that government, and we pointed out that a woman who also was abroad in 1994 had nothing to do with any of it, who lived in Holland, but she wanted to return to her country. But she's a Hutu, and she said, I want to see democracy. I want to be able to run for president of the country like anybody else. If it's a free country, that's what I want to do. So she goes back, and then they arrest her and accuse her of advocating terror. And then they bring her to court wearing a little pink costume and with her head shaved, and they always make sure that she has manacles on. But the Canadian government doesn't see anything strange about this. And if you ask Human Rights Watch and you ask Amnesty, they say, well, we're not happy with the Mugesera case. But, you know, the justice system there is improving. You know what that means to me? It's like saying the South is improving. There have been fewer lynchings this year. You know, we've been checking. You know, last year was kind of, there were 56. It's down now to 27, 26. I mean, we don't know why you're making a fuss, because we only lynched 26 people, you know. This is where we are. But again, listen, be careful. If you, as the old saying, you can give a dog a bad name and you can kill it. So they gave Lynn Mugesera a bad name. They hung it around his neck, which, and on the bottom of the sign, it says, kick me. So everybody joins in kicking it. They have no idea who he is. I can tell you, having met him, he's a very sensitive, very bright, extremely bright, very eloquent man, and probably a little too eloquent, because he talks readily, and if you ask him his opinion, he'll tell you. The speech he gave, by the way, in 1992 that so offended everybody was in reaction to the fact that his country had been invaded from Uganda, and he was wondering why people weren't doing more to fight back. Because he couldn't believe that this was going on, rather like Bishop Strawn here in Toronto. He couldn't understand why people weren't joining the militia and fighting. And so he said so. And so, of course, they wanted to round him up, you know. It's nothing very remarkable there. And the people who believe in human rights and free speech, they're really... They get tested when a thing like this happens, because they say, oh, does he have a bad reputation? Because I don't want to defend anybody with a bad reputation. Well, that means you're never going to defend anybody, because when they get ready to accuse somebody, believe me, they're going to make sure he has a bad reputation. He's not going to get his rights. So, anyhow, that said, we will probably next week be talking. I know Philippe LaRochelle is a wonderful lawyer, and has done a good job of fighting on behalf of Leon, as has the lawyer who defended him on the specific accusation. So one or another of them we will get to talk to. Anyhow, Phil, by the way, that's a long speech. Yeah. You have been checking for us. We're going to talk to Zafar Menkes, but you have the news on when he's speaking, because we're going to tell people about that.
If you can allow me one indulgence as a postscript in the Mugesera thing, on today's CBC online news, where the public is invited to comment, if you want to see a lynch mob, you should see the kind of things that are said about Leon Mugesera by anonymous posters on the CBC's website. I'm not talking about the Toronto Sun's website or anybody else. I'm talking about the CBC's. It is hate propaganda. It is actually people calling for violence, which the CBC seems happy to post. It is actually referring to him as an animal in another kind of disgusting language. And it's like it is like a lynch mob. Chasing its victim to certain death, which is what will be his fate in Rwanda.
Personally, I don't know that that's the case. Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, he's going to be, my guess, I don't know what they're going to do with him, but it is not just what is being done. And that government has no right to ask for him. They have no right to ask for him. So long as they are holding people like Victoire Ingabire for simply trying to put her name forward to be candidate for president, a totally nonviolent person who was not present for the terrible events of 1994, if they bring her into court in shackles for the fun of it with her head shaved, no, you don't cooperate. You just say to them, hey, listen, ask somebody else. Don't ask us for us to turn over a prisoner to you.
By the way, that's an interesting point. This is a deportation, not an extradition, right? And we don't fly directly from Montreal to Rwanda. So he should be given the opportunity to try to find some country that would let him come in.
Well, he has asked for that. Yeah. No, but that was – this is – that's why I say it's a poster boy. This is one where they want to say, this is us liking this government. Mm-hmm. We're chummy. I mean, President Kagame of Rwanda has a personal unpaid advisor, Tony Blair. Unpaid. How come the former prime minister of Britain is the unpaid advisor to a guy who runs a government in the manner that he runs at? So what that means is everybody's on side. His second big friend is Bill Clinton. So he's not doing too bad in the friend department. Paul Wolfowitz likes to go there. They've even brought a cultural thing in. They've brought others to build up the legend of this character, who he's just a general. I don't fault him, and I don't even care about him. When I worked on this case from the beginning, when I arrived in Arusha, Tanzania, I said I wouldn't want this court to try Paul Kagame. Whatever happens, I agree with Mr. Rudasingwa, who was our guest last week. This is for Rwandans to decide. I don't believe that you're going to get a tribunal that's going to bring any justice. It was in the UN tribunal where Alison DeFord was permitted to say, I'm not going to say where I got this tape. That was something. Anyway,
sorry for that diversion.
You're going to give me the news.
Yes. On Thursday, January 26th, in Hamilton at McMaster Hospital, Zafar Bangladesh will address a meeting organized by the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War and other organizations. Iran in the crosshairs. And Zafar Bangash, I know, on that subject will have a lot to say. That's McMaster Hospital, the Ewart Angus Center, room 1A6, on Thursday, January 26th at 7:30 p.m.
Good, thanks.
And that's a free admission, and the hat will be passed.
A hat will be passed. Great. What am I cheering that for? Anyhow, okay. Now, there's an important statement that has come from the International Action Center. There's a great concern, and this is why we're talking to Zafar later in the program, is because of potential war over these issues of Syria and Iran. And the former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, has issued a statement and asking people to sign on, and this is how it reads. I don't know that I'll read it all, but we should be aware of this. Another Iranian scientist, Mustafa Roshan, has been assassinated in Iran by a car bomb. This is the fifth Iranian scientist targeted by assassins working in Iran in 2 years. Four attacks succeeded. This is a deadly escalation of the covert criminal activities conducted by the U.S., Israel, and their terrorists and domestic spies in Iran against the government and people of Iran. While Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has denied any U.S. involvement, the important and undeniable truth is that the government of the U.S. and Israel have openly declared Iran as an enemy and have publicly stated that they will use all means necessary, not excluding military attack, to change the Iranian government using Iran's efforts to produce nuclear energy as an excuse. The assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists is an effort to create fear in the Iranian people, opposition to their own government, and monopolize nuclear research and development of nuclear power. The aim is to stop Iran's drive for industrial and technological independence, on which the independence of Iran and the freedom of its people depends. Those who forget the past are condemned to its repetition. Do we remember the Shah, who ruled Iran for 25 years on behalf of the U.S., had a huge nuclear energy program intended to replace depleted fossil fuels? Do we remember that? Do we realize his billions of dollars of arms purchased from the U.S. with wealth of the Iranian people helped fund U.S. arms research, development, and production that now threaten Iran? In the decades since the Shah fled, sanctions, sabotage, and threats have escalated into dangerous new decisions to send a U.S. nuclear aircraft carrier, destroyers, and nuclear submarines into the Persian Gulf and impose harsher sanctions on trade and an oil embargo. All of these threats are threats against peace and are violations of international law. A just society can have no interest in stopping the peaceful progress of other nations and peoples. No to another war for oil, no to foreign government domination and foreign corporate exploitation of Iran or any other country. And this is, you can go to stopwaroniran.org. They're asking people to sign on with this petition drafted by former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, who has been a guest on our program. And who knows a great deal about what he's talking about. One of the things I learned from working around him was that he said, you have to appreciate how much power, how much pressure they can bring to bear on people. And they can just crack, you know, a sovereign country. And they say, well, we want you to do something. And that sovereign country says no. He says, he was in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. He says there's all kinds of pressure. It is remarkable that so anybody stands up to them at all, because they you will pay a price for saying no to them. I guess a cultural note before we talk to Zafar. I got a couple of things I would like to talk about. I have a proposal for a historical reenactment, because it's the War of 1812 time, and everybody thinks that a historical reenactment has to be, oh, you know, guns and bang bang, but I have a better I have an idea that I think we should all join in on, and I want to base it on a letter. This is the foundation for my historical reenactment. This is a letter from Isaac Chauncey to Judge Scott, and it says, or Judge Powell, and it's found at the New York Historical Society, the Isaac Chauncey letter book. And it's from his ship, the General Pike, and it's off Niagara, 14th of November, 1813. He writes, when the squadron under my command visited York in April last year, much to my mortification, I discovered that some of the men had pillaged a number of books belonging to the Toronto Library. As soon as the circumstances were made known to me, I interdicted all intercourse with the shore until a general search was made and all the books in the fleet collected and boxed up, with the intention of having them returned immediately. But circumstances, in some degree beyond my control, have prevented my carrying those wishes into execution before this late period. I have now the pleasure of sending you, by the Lady of the Lake, flag of truce, two boxes containing all of the books that were taken from York by any person belonging to the fleet. I have no doubt whatever but that many others were taken by the soldiers and will be further lost to the library. But I am confident that it was owing to the extreme indisposition of General Dearborn that they were not collected and returned. I think he's getting in a dig at the general, because he's a Navy man. He said, I found all those books, but forget the Army. Then he says, I beg you, sir, to assure the trustees of the Toronto Library that has been a source of great mortification to myself and officers, that so useful an institution should not have been deemed sacred by every person under our command. You, however, sir, must be aware that it is not always in the power of officers with the best disposition to control those placed under them, situated as they were at York. So I want a historical reenactment. I want the Lady of the Lake to come across and under a flag of truce and sail up to Toronto, Yonge Street, and bring two boxes of books to return to the Toronto Library, and with a letter saying that he was mortified that they had not been treated as sacred. And then I want the librarians to say they are overdue, and there is some water damage, and we're going to be discussing all of those things. But thank you for your gesture. Anyway, okay. Now, we will work on a historical reenactment. We have till April. As a matter of fact, it would be 2013.
Do you think that Mayor Ford would allocate some money for the reenactment?
I don't. He would. He can't let Chauncey look better than him, can he? I mean, he's got to at least. Sure. I mean, we said that ball's in your court, Ford. You know, the barbarian who attacked us in 1813 is mortified that he took books. So you can't make him look better than you. Here's your chance, you know. So, yes, I think that here's a chance. But that's my idea of a historical reenactment. I think we'll take a break, and we'll come back and talk to Zafar Bengash.
Hi, I'm Angus Toulouse, Regional Chief for the 133 First Nation communities located in Ontario and approximately 200,000 First Nation citizens. First Nations people talk a lot about treaties, This is because the treaties form the basis of our relationship with the federal and provincial governments. Treaties were made in order to set the terms of our relationships and the conditions upon which land and resources would be shared. The treaties allowed non-Indigenous people to settle and develop the land now known as Ontario. Unfortunately, many treaty promises remain unfulfilled. Today, when there is a conflict over land or resources, it is more than likely due to the lack of respect for treaty commitments. The treaties we share cover most of the landmass known as Ontario, and they remain just as relevant today as the day they were made. I encourage you to learn more about our shared history and our treaties. First Nations, Ontarians, Canadians, we are all here to stay.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Been on the year, been on the air for 25 years, and of alternative radio, independent radio, special radio. And you go to CIUT.FM, check out all the, there's talk about our 25th, and there's going to be photographs. We had a great celebration at our new studios. They destroyed the old building. We escaped, but we're here. And we had a terrific event here. So CIUT.FM, you get all the news, but the big story is that we're the little station that does, so we're still here. And 25 more would be nice. We're going to be talking to Zafar Bengash. He is at crescent-online.net, and there's important news from all over the place. The Syria matter with the Arab League and its peculiar the politics of that outfit, a sight to behold. By the way, the CBC, somebody there, I think it was As It Happens, had a program where their idea of an authority to go to talk about this was somebody you would appreciate from the Henry Jackson Institute for Human Rights. And the bigger name for him, he was called Scoop Jackson. And He was a senator from Boeing, and he had a nickname Boom Boom, I think. That's their approach to human rights work. Yeah. So if you have an altercation in Syria, and which is, you know, volatile, dangerous, you go to the guys who are closest to the State Department. You don't want any gap. You go. Apparently, Susan Rice was busy, so they thought, well, okay, go to number two.
You know, I'm really struck by the fact that all the stuff about Syria in the newspapers, and the Globe has this Patrick Markin on the job day and night, nobody ever goes and talks to a Syrian government representative and asks them for their point of view.
Never.
You cannot find it in a Canadian newspaper. What is the point of view of the Syrian government?
No, and by the way, in the region, there are plenty of very well-informed people in the region who are very worried and not buying all the hype about this. For the big reason, starting with Libya, people think they were lied to because they were lied to. And so they are not happy, and they say, oh, now you want to bomb somebody else. You tell us, for example, usually starts with a no-fly. But then it starts a free fly for NATO and free bomb. And if you hit something, it's an enemy, because by definition, you've already defined it. That's what you're doing. So that's how it's to be reported. So, of course, there's skepticism, but also Syria is strategically more important. And I shouldn't say more, but it just is important because unlike Libya, they did not move away. With the fall of the Soviet Union and the kind of the realignment of power, they didn't run into the arms or attempt to get into the arms of Berlusconi or of Sarkozy. They didn't give any money to the Syrians. and so this one is going to be a harder nut to crack. But that isn't to say that the great nutcracker ain't coming to do it. That's what, if you ask a soldier, why are you a soldier? That's his answer. And so, by the way, that's something we should remark on. There's a great website, Stop NATO, which we cite and we've talked. That's Rick Rossoff. You can find that on the net. Provides a great background for this kind of matter. And just on that, points that they make apropos of Syria is that if you this kind of military man, you know, can you take out that government? The answer has to be yes. He can't say, no, I can't do that. He says, of course I can. But, of course, but when you don't realize, I mean, the civilians need to think that's what they're there for. Is this something we want done? Because what's going to be the price? If you know, the Americans had a little civil war. They thought, well, this will be over in 6 months. Well, it took 4 years, and about 500,000 of them got killed. If they had all realized that before they started, maybe they would have talked the problem through.
I want to emphasize today's Globe and Mail. Patrick Martin acknowledges that the majority of the Syrian population supports the president of Syria and the current government. He buries it in the article. He just passes over it, but there it is, right?
Yeah.
That who's ever making this little rebellion, they don't speak for the Syrian people. And,
right. Yeah. But by the way, you can have a dispute about what percentage of those people speak. Should there be other parties? But I thought that went on in every country of the world. You know, there are Americans who've been told they can't have parties because of things they've said or done. And there are people in every country that have had difficulty. But we've had people here say, well, okay, we have a separatist party. You should arrest those people. Some people say that. Well, okay, so suppose they did arrest them. Well, does that mean that the solution to that is that Britain and France say we're going to have a no-fly zone until you unarrest them? You know, people would say, no, that's not how you reason. But you see, this is a colonial mind. Well, no, of course we're the ones who are going to go away to do this to them.
I also noticed that the spokespeople for the Arab League who are criticizing Syria the most heaviest are all royalists. They're princes and people of that ilk from Saudi Arabia and from some of the smaller Gulf states.
You've outed yourself as an anti-monarchist.
I mean, Syria is a country that is secular and modern in its political structure. It doesn't have the kind of political leadership that you have in Saudi Arabia, where you inherit it or you get it by virtue of the position you hold in religion. It's a secular state, and it's a multicultural, multi-ethnic state.
Well, as Ramsey Clark pointed out on our program, he was talking about this, and he said, look, Syria is having a lot of stress, not all of it because of this merely the confrontation with Western powers who are now trying to achieve diktat to them using the Arab monarchies. By the way, if there's, you know, let's acknowledge the vanguard of democracy in the Middle East is now every last monarchy. And the more absolute you are, the more you are the leader of the democratic forces. Which brings us to Zafar Benghazi, who I don't think believes that. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes. Hello, Phil. How are you?
Very good.
I'm sorry I got sort of tied up.
Oh, that's okay. You gave us a chance to pontificate.
That's good.
And we had just come to the really vital point here, which is we were talking about who is this group of people who are telling the Syrian government that they now have to, the president has to step down. They even have a little ABC. You will step down, you will share power with the opposition, and you will do this in 2 weeks.
That's a very good question. I mean, can you imagine that?
Whoa, who is that?
These people that call themselves the Arab League, and this is a bunch of yo-yos that have absolutely no...
That's more like it. Political science. I took that course.
No authority, no representation, even in their own countries.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, for some reason, they think that they have the authority to tell the Syrian government what to do and what not to do. I was really struck by a announcement that was made that the group of Arab parliamentarians that are affiliated with the Arab League, they have also demanded of the Syrian government to adhere to their demands. Otherwise, there would be terrible consequences. And I was thinking, which country in the Middle East has had elections to have parliamentarians who are making these demands of the Syrian government?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't hear of any elections being held anywhere. Only now, in recent weeks, we have had a few countries go through elections. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, they are all dictatorships, and yet they talk about Arab parliamentarians, and these have this is a group that has existed for quite a few years. So
But you know, and we're speaking to Zafar Benghazi, crescent-online.net. He's speaking, by the way, Wednesday night at McMaster.
Thursday night.
I'm sorry, Thursday night. Boy, I'm glad we have you on the air. Thursday night at McMaster. And do we have the room number?
Yes, the Ewart Angus Center, room 1A6, 7:30 p.m.
Great. Now, Zafar, this point about, you know, they're monarchs, and they're saying to him, look, you got to step down. You got to do it in 2 weeks, and you got to share power with this unknown group that has guns from somewhere else. I'm wondering about, he seems, in his response to them, very formal. And very correct, and he's sort of trying to get along with them, saying, well, look, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. But wouldn't the world be better served if he simply said, nice to hear from you. By the way, I'd be happy to share power when you do it.
I think he should have said that. I think we should send a message to him to say that, you know, you can make an offer to these guys.
As soon as you have a parliament, Your Highness, and you have a premier, and you share power with the premier, then I'll do that. And matter of fact, you're the leader, so I'll follow.
I'll follow you first. Absolutely.
Well,
I think that's a wonderful suggestion. I think we better send it out to them.
Let's do that.
Yes.
There are people, by the way, who say that about the Assad government, that they tend to... They're playing along too much. It's almost like they understand they're in a kind of a logical box.
Right.
They've agreed to certain things because they're trying to make nice.
Yes.
But they're doing it with people who are not making nice. These people are out for the head of Assad, and they also want to bring in somebody rather unknown to the rest of it. It's going to be the mystery guest.
Yes.
Now, who is the mystery guest? Who are these guys with the guns, and where did they get the guns?
Exactly. These people that are... They're with the guns, etc. They have most of these guns are being given to them through Jordan, another of those roaring democracies in the Middle East, where the other king, King Hussein, was about to die of cancer back in 1999. He rushed back to Jordan to displace the crown prince, who was going to be his brother, Prince Hassan, and instead appointed his own son to become the king. And so from Jordan, a lot of weapons are being smuggled into Syria, and these are paid for by the Saudis, that other very great democracy in the Middle East, where when one brother dies, then... the other takes over.
And presidents and prime ministers come and kiss their hand and say, oh, I'm so sorry.
Yes.
So sorry.
Exactly. And these are the kinds
of... He gave me a horse once. I love that horse.
Yeah. So these are the kinds of people that are basically making demands of the Syrian government at the present time. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, there was a survey done by... a group called the Doha Debates, which is run by the BBC, in that it is interesting that the survey found that 55% of the Syrian people wanted President Bashar al-Assad to remain in power. This was a survey done by the BBC under their the Doha Debates label. And they also expanded this survey to people outside Syria, not Syrians living outside, but in other Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, etc. And they found out that 81% of the Arab people wanted Bashar al-Assad to resign. But within Syria, 55% of the Syrian people wanted him to stay as president. Mm-hmm. So when this... The report was published on the BBC, on their website. They simply reported that 81% of the Arabs want Bashar al-Assad to resign without saying that 55% of the Syrians want him to stay.
The people whose country it is.
So you see this bizarre situation over there that, you know, every outsider wants to tell the other how he should run his country or what he should do. but they're just simply not prepared to consider their own internal situation.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, this is Zafar Bengash, and it's crescent-online.net. And Zafar is speaking Thursday in Hamilton at McMaster University at, is it 7 o'clock?
7:30.
Now, there, it's been suggested, there's a gentleman I read, he's a very sarcastic professor at a Lebanese, a very, very bright fellow called the Angry Arab, if people are looking for him. And he's one of the things, he's not, he doesn't like anybody, which of course makes it difficult to, for when one reads him to understand what he's thinking about. But he does raise a question. I wonder what your thoughts are. He says that the Syrian government attacks a lot of people for bothering them, and as well they should. I don't know why they don't tell people just to leave them alone. But he says that they are shy about getting into a fight with Saudi Arabia. Why would that be, or is it true, and why would that be?
Well, I don't know if this is true, but the way I read the situation is that the Syrian government obviously is playing a fairly sophisticated game in the sense that they don't want to open too many fronts for themselves. They want to see if they can manage this crisis that they are facing without picking on fights with too many people. For instance, the Syrians have agreed to Arab League monitors to come to their country, but they also put down certain conditions, which were that their military bases, etc., would not be open to these monitors because they don't want
spies.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Personally, that would be my first.
That's correct. And so, although they are obviously not happy with the Saudis, because the Saudis naturally have been instigating this trouble in Syria for quite a while, they are the ones that are financing it. And the Saudis, of course, are working very closely with the Americans as well as the Israelis. And so, naturally, the Syrians are not happy about it. But what they want to do is to see if they can resolve this crisis through discussions and negotiations. Mm-hmm. It's something that it's of interest to note that the proposals that the Syrian government has made to have a dialogue with the opposition forces, the groups that are within Syria, the political groups I'm talking about, they are open to holding a dialogue with the Syrian government. But the groups that are sitting outside Syria, whether in Paris or Turkey or anywhere else, they adamantly refuse to have any discussion with the government of Syria.
And they're escalating, right? Exactly. They're calling for a Libya-style operation.
Correct. They are basically, this whole notion of the Free Syrian Army is actually a cover for foreign interference in Syria. Because, I mean, true, there are some members of the Syrian armed forces that have defected, but their number is quite insignificant. But their label is very useful for the foreign opposition forces because they want to use that label by saying, well, we are getting thousands of Syrian troops to defect from the army, and they are joining us, whereas in fact, many of these people that go under the label of the Free Syrian Army are actually mercenaries from places like Jordan or Lebanon or these other places that are opposed to the Syrian government because the Syrian government is part of what we refer to as the resistance front that comprises the Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Palestine, and Iran. This resistance front against Israeli occupation of Palestine and of Lebanese territory. So the whole thrust of what is happening in Syria, although the Syrian people definitely have legitimate grievances, I mean, definitely it would be worthwhile if they were given their political rights and that they were there were more freedoms that they enjoyed. But the overall thrust of the turmoil is not necessarily the rights of the Syrian people. It is basically to undermine the resistance front against Israel. Mm-hmm. That's why we find the Lebanese involved, like, you know, Hariri and yes. his gang.
Yes.
The Jordanians are involved, the Saudis are involved, the Israelis and the Americans. They're yes. all working on this to try to overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad.
And they're looking down the line at the Islamic Republic.
Exactly.
And which brings up, now I want to raise this issue of how they're using this label Arab League as though it's unanimous. My understanding is that Algeria is not in favor of any of this stuff.
That's correct.
Lebanon
as well as Iraq, they have opposed these things. They've said that
Iraq is kind of an important one to mention, right? Because this is the great liberated democratic, you know, now everything is fine. If everything is fine, why doesn't anybody listen to what they're saying?
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, you know, there was a very interesting episode in mid-December when the American forces were about to leave Iraq. There was this ceremony in one of the military bases, and this American general was talking to an Iraqi officer through an interpreter. So the general suggested to the Iraqi military officer, probably an Iraqi general, through the interpreter, that what we should do is to have a ceremony over here in honor of the soldiers that have fallen, both American as well as Iraqis, in bringing democracy to Iraq. And so when the interpreter interpreted to the Iraqi officer, to the Iraqi general, that this is what the American general is saying, the Iraqi general, without waiting for the interpreter to interpret his words, he just turned around to the American general and said, "No ceremony, get out."
Oh.
I think it was...
Does that sound like gratitude to you? Yeah, it illustrates, and so it is Iraq, and it is, and people need to know this. So they are using the letters AL, the Arab League says, Arab League this, Arab League that, but Iraq is a rather important member.
Exactly.
And Lebanon is a very important, and Algeria, these are, we all know these are big names. And sure. By the way, their populations overwhelm the monarchies of the Gulf.
Of course.
And yet, because of the Gulf's little game of creating a majority by having, they say, this city is a country, this city is a country, this
exactly.
island is a country. Then they say, and we combine, I say this about Syria, when in fact the great majority of Arabs haven't agreed at all.
That's correct, yes. You see, now, when you even look at, there are, the United Arab Emirates, they have, they're basically, they used to be tent cities. Now they obviously have concrete and glass towers that they have built. But they're still, you know, city-states, mm-hmm. and they each of them carries the label of a country.
Yeah.
And the same with Qatar and Bahrain and these other, you know, tiny, tiny little statelets that were created by the British in order to advance their own colonial interests. And they're, of course, still protected by Britain and the United States. And these are the statelets that are members of the Arab League, and they think that they have the right to demand that Syria ought to do this or that or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Remind our listeners, this is Zafar Bengage, crescent-online.net. He's speaking Thursday at McMaster University in Hamilton about this threat of war with the Islamic Republic, which is, as we speak, I guess now there's a second U.S. Super aircraft carrier has arrived in the Gulf, am I right?
Yes, that is correct, yes. The Abraham Lincoln has been sent over there, and obviously the...
Tears are running down my face.
You see, the Americans, for some reason, think that they have the right to barge into that region, and yet they are threatening all kinds of things against Iran. They have not only imposed a raft of sanctions But there's also a campaign of sabotage and assassination of Iranian professors and nuclear scientists, etc. And the other factor, of course, is that this hysteria that is being created about war, if America should launch that, I personally believe that the consequences are going to be really horrendous for the whole world.
Yes. By the way, this it won't be one of those offshore exercises.
Exactly. Absolutely.
You can't know where it will lead.
Exactly. It is not going to, number one, any attack on Iran would have a major blowback because Iran has the capacity to hit back and hit back really hard. And even if, let's say, they do not close the Strait of Hormuz, through which about 20% of the world's oil flows, even if they don't close that, I'm absolutely convinced that Iran has complete capacity to destroy Saudi oil fields, the Kuwaiti oil fields, and oil fields of a number of other countries over there, because Iran has said that if we cannot export oil, we will make sure that nobody else can either.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you're going to strangle us, we'll make sure that we strangle you.
Well, that's what the Americans said the War of 1812 was.
Yeah.
They said, you cannot tell us who we're going to trade with or tell us that we cannot trade.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, this is a case that somebody just should hold up the mirror.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Zafar, we probably should point out, this is a time also not to have illusions. Jimmy Carter was the first to talk this way.
Yeah.
I mean, he made a big – you recall they said, you know, you have the Shah. The world understands what he is, and you must not allow him to come to your country because he's a wanted man. And the U.S. brought him in, it just to kind of like an insult.
Correct. Exactly. And so, you know, these kinds of things, unfortunately, the American people, by and large, have been kept in the dark about. But there's a long history of American and British interference in Iran. And now, of course, since the Islamic Revolution 33 years ago, that the Iranians have decided that they want to pursue an independent policy, whether one agrees with them or not in terms of, you know, what they are doing internally. But the fact of the matter is that they want to pursue an independent policy. They want to maintain their independence and their sovereignty and their integrity. And they are constantly being undermined and being threatened. And
over the issue of they might develop a nuclear weapon when, in fact, they do not have one.
Exactly.
And they are a signatory to international agreements.
Exactly.
Whereas the two countries talking to them this way, one of them has already used nuclear weapons against people, and the other one, Israel, is not a signatory to any international agreements.
Exactly.
And yet it possesses. I mean, we have to be stark, staring mad not to discuss that first, before we talk about anything about the Islamic Republic.
Iran is on record as having said that they would like to have a nuclear-free Middle East. They have repeatedly offered that they would like to have a nuclear-free Middle East.
And the people of the region agree with them.
The people of the region agree with them. You know what America says? America says, no, they're trying to undermine Israel. I mean, wait a minute. You are saying that nuclear weapons are dangerous. And of course they are. And yet when Iran says, okay, you say that nuclear weapons are dangerous, so we are saying, let's eliminate them from the Middle East. And then America turns around and says, no, you are undermining Israel.
Yes.
So what it means is that as far as the U.S. is concerned, and incidentally a number of other countries, Western countries, that Israel can have nuclear weapons, but nobody else should have them in the region.
I think that's the golden rule. They make the rule.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, it's been great talking. It's Zafar Ben-Geis, crescent-online.net. He's speaking Thursday at McMaster. In Hamilton at 7:30. Thanks an awful lot, Zafar.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So, thanks, Carol. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Phil, too. And write to us, Taylor. It's CIUT.FM and check us, Taylor-Report.com, and see you next week.